Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Today, it's a year-end edition of the Local News Roundup as we look back at the top stories of 2018. We'll discuss a tumultuous year in education, a fatal shooting at Butler High School, controversy over a new charter school law, and big changes on campuses to come. 2018 was when Billy Graham's lifetime of preaching around the world ended at age 99. The Carolina Panthers found a new owner and said goodbye to their old one, who left with his reputation in tatters. We still don't know who's going to Congress from the 9th District. Hurricane Florence caused $17 billion worth of damage and cost dozens of lives in North Carolina. Plus, we have tollways opened and delayed, and, most importantly, scooters. Joining me today are Ann Doss Helms of the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
Glenn Berkins from Q City Metro.
Good morning.
Steve Harrison from WFAE.
Good morning.
And David Borax from WFAE.
Hello, Eric.
Welcome, one and all. So, no shortage of news this year in Charlotte. Let's start with a story that's likely to last well into 2019, and that would be the unresolved congressional race we thought that Mark Harris won in November, that is, until the usually mundane matter of certifying the results turned into something else entirely. And it started with State Elections Board Vice Chair Josh Malcolm saying this.
I'm very familiar with unfortunate activities that have been happening down in my part of the state, and I am not going to turn a blind eye to what took place.
So, Steve Harrison, let's start with you. What happened next?
So the Board of Elections voted unanimously not to certify the 9th congressional district race, and then kind of a national media frenzy ensued where it was discovered that a political operative working for Mark Harris ran a very aggressive slash illegal, possibly illegal, absentee mail vote program. And the big question was whether McRae Dowless in Blaine County was illegally picking up absentee ballots, also known as harvesting. And so that has led to this point where there will be an investigation, a public hearing in January by the state board, possibly a new election. And we could be sitting here a year from now talking about this exact same story as the top news of 2019.
So, Glenn, I'm wondering, or I'm guessing, that you've probably given some thought to what the head of the state Democratic Party has said in recent days about state lawmakers focusing on a voter ID law while we have an absentee ballot fraud, scam, whatever you want to call it, while we have this all these allegations out there. Is there a bit of a disconnect when we look at those two things?
It's amazing. It seems no one wants to really talk about that, especially on the Republican side. The Republican Party has made such a such an issue out of voter fraud and the need to ferret out any potential for voter fraud. But whether we're talking about on the state level or even the national level, the party has really been quiet about this. And I think one of the interesting things will be watching how this unfolds to see if this was something isolated or if this is more of a national problem. I would imagine, and I don't have any inside information, but I would imagine if I were the New York Times or the Washington Post, I would have a team of reporters looking at that very question.
I think the two parties have been going around trying to figure out where is the political advantage here. And people remember, first of all, let me just say that this is an issue that going back in history, we're now learning that this particular political operative who is under investigation worked for both Democrats and Republicans. But this more recent case involving the Harris-McCready race, the Republicans have been outraged that this is being slowed down. But then they came out in the second week of December with a statement saying, you know, if there was wrongdoing here, we should absolutely have a new election on this. And then A few days later, the tide turned again, and we heard the Republicans saying, we want Mark Harris certified as the winner immediately. And so it's not clear.
What's with the whiplash?
I think they're trying to figure out where's the advantage here. And obviously, they'd like to see Mark Harris seated, or at least a Republican of some kind. But, you know, this investigation is in the middle right now. As Steve mentioned, there'll be state Board of Elections hearings in January, starting January 11th, about this, and more of this will come out into the public realm. But we are not, it seems unlikely that we will have any Republican or Democrat seated before January.
And even after January, we have the whole issue of the Democrat-controlled House of Representatives in Washington. Will they seat him? How will they respond to that? So. I would imagine we'll be talking about this well into the new year.
Yeah, I hope Steve was sort of exaggerating when he said we might be doing the same thing at this time.
I know, I kind of winced inside.
The last time that we had a vacancy that we had no representation was in the 12th district when Mel Watt resigned to take a federal job in January, and I think that was 2014, and then Governor Pat McCrory said, well, let's just hold the election in November when we're going to have elections anyway. So we don't really have a precedent for how long it would take. I mean, I suppose the quickest resolution would be if the state board says we've looked at this, we don't think there were enough unusual votes to change that, we're just going to certify Mark Harris. That's looking increasingly unlikely. So if there is a new primary and or a new general election, how much time do you allow for a campaign? You know, how much time for filing? This is really kind of unknown territory for us.
I do wonder, Steve, you were in Bladen County. You've been following this very closely, going back through the 2016 documents with McCrae Dallas. So when we get to January 11th, and let's say the State Board of Elections makes a decision, whatever that decision is, how likely do you think it is that that decision sticks?
You know, right now, there's kind of a lot of different questions. They can order on January 11th a new election. Right now, the law says they can only order a new general election, but there's this bill that has been passed in the legislature that would require a new primary. The governor has said he would veto it, not because of that reason, but for other reasons. So we've got kind of this question mark, is there a new primary or not? I think there's a lot of Republicans who are sitting kind of waiting to see, like, well, do I jump in the race? I think if Robert Pittenger, the incumbent, I think if he decides to run again, I think probably a lot of people sit on the sidelines and let him have another shot at Mark Harris. You know, Dan McCready, would win if there is a new Democratic primary. But there's so many unknowns about what's going to happen in the new year.
Now, while Harris and McCready in the 9th District take up all the oxygen in the room, the election did determine at least a few things in North Carolina, including the end of the veto-proof majorities in the General Assembly. Here's reaction from Senator Jeff Jackson, a Charlotte Democrat.
We're going to be able to go back into session in a position to sustain the governor's vetoes, which reshapes our state's political landscape in a way that allows it to take a big step closer to the center, which is where our state is. We're a true 50-50 state, and we've been governed by the far right for this entire decade. And that is, as of now, over.
So that's over, but the legislature is starting up next month. What kind of impact do we expect from this, I guess, loss of the supermajority in both the House and the Senate for the Republicans?
I think it's mainly going to be defensive. The Democrats will have the defense to sustain a veto, but they still don't have the power to enact legislation. I think they'll be a stronger party, the Democratic Party, but it will primarily be defensive.
I think too. So one thing that will be interesting to watch is that the Democrats broke the supermajority in large part because they did really well in urban areas, including Mecklenburg. They had a near clean sweep of defeating every Republican legislator except one, Dan Bishop. And so what that's done is it's made the Republican Party in charge. It is more rural. There's less representation from the city. So Charlotte really now has very minimal influence over the majority party. And it'll be interesting to see what that means for the city going forward. I mean, before, Charlotte wasn't anyone's favorite, but there were Republican members in the House and the Senate that could speak up for the city, and that's almost all gone now.
That's the voice of Steve Harrison from WFAE. You're listening to the Local News Roundup. The rest of our panel includes David Borax from WFAE, Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer, and Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro. Steve, I wanted to go back to you for a minute. Mecklenburg County, with the Board of Commissioners, went from a 6-3 majority for Democrats to 9-0. First time in 50 years we have had a clean sweep for the Democrats. What do you see happening in that realm?
So I think the biggest decision that the county will have to make, there will be in January, the new property valuations will go out. It will be much, much higher for businesses and residential. So everyone's going to get sticker shock. Then you have to have a situation where the county and the city decide where to set their tax rate. They will lower the rate, but the question is, will they go back to the so-called revenue neutral rate where they collected the same money as before? And you know, I think if you still had three Republicans on the county commission, there would have been a much louder voice to push that rate down as far as possible. Now there may be a situation where people feel like, hey, we now have money for parks, we have now money for schools. So I think that's going to be a big fight in the new year.
I think this could be a perilous situation for the Democrats, just as Justice Steve said. If they don't handle this right, if they handle it improperly, if taxpayers see their property taxes go up an exorbitant amount, I think the Democrats could pay for that. This is definitely a Democrat county, but I would not, if I were them, I would not think that gave me a free hand to do whatever we wanted to do in terms of property tax.
I think there are a few Democrats in the county who feel a little uncomfortable with this situation of being, of holding all the seats on the county commission and controlling the city council the way they do. And that's something that they'll have to deal with in the coming year. One other point about looking back at the statewide situation. Remember the congressional districts in North Carolina were redrawn and then put on hold by the courts right before this election that we're all still talking about. So in addition to continuing to talk about the 9th district in particular, later sometime in 2019, we're going to have to talk about a redistricting again. And, the Republicans in the state legislature will have to redraw those districts again and satisfy the court that they've got something that works right now. And just to remind people what the situation is, statewide, Republicans got 50% of the votes, but they ended up winning 10 of the 13 congressional seats. So just looking at the House delegation, you know, it's out of whack. And that situation remains, and it's something that we're going to have to deal with in 2019.
Kind of going back to what they were talking about with the taxing and the spending locally, I was in a school board committee meeting a day or so after the election, and school board members of both parties were saying they felt like this was going to be potentially a county commission that would be more receptive to their pitches for money. Obviously, that's the biggest item in the county budget is spending on education, and a couple of the Republican members who were defeated or were left, Jim Puckett, Bill James, some of those people have been harshly critical of CMS and the way it spends its money. At the same time, they were also acknowledging this isn't just going to be an open checkbook, that some of the constraints ultimately have always been the amount of money that's available. And again, that's going to go back to how much are you willing to, you know, increase that revenue stream at the expense of the taxpayers and the other important needs that are out there.
That was Andos Helms. When we come back, we're going to talk about a very busy and often sad year in education, including gun violence coming to Butler High and the worry of guns in schools across Charlotte-Mecklenburg. You're listening to the Year in Review on the Local News Roundup. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. This is the Local News Roundup. We're taking a look at 2018 and the top stories, and our panel includes David Borax from WFAE, Andos Helms of the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, and Steve Harrison from WFAE. So, Anne, as I mentioned it before the break, this year, too many stories about education involved violence. 56 students died in school shootings this year, including 17 in Parkland, Florida in February. And in October, a Butler High student lost his life after being shot on the campus in Matthews. This is how one student remembered that day.
I see wrestling. The two kids are wrestling. And then I'm right there. I hear pop, pop, pop. And everyone's running.
So, Anne, give us some context here of not only what happened, but what changes this is likely to lead to.
Well, you think about it, the kids who are in high school now are the Columbine generation. They've always grown up with lockdowns and with at least some remote knowledge that mass shootings can happen in schools, which is horrible just on its face. I almost did a double take when I had to remember it was just this year that the Parkland shooting happened on Valentine's Day, and that really rattled, I think, a lot of teenagers. So the scope of the violence, then the power of the students who went out and spoke about how things need to change. Over the spring, there were thousands of students in the Charlotte area going on protests saying we want better protection, we want everything from better counseling in schools to stricter gun laws. You know, we want to be safe in school, and we're not safe in school. At that point, we had a history, many, many years' history, of guns being found on Charlotte-Mecklenburg school campuses, fortunately almost never being fired. It was generally a situation where one student would go to an administrator or the school resource officer and say, hey, so-and-so's got something in their locker or book bag, and it would be confiscated. And that changed this October. There was a, sounds like, from what we know, and there has not been a trial yet, but there, from the reports and videos we've seen, there was a fight over the weekend, and they came in on a Monday morning, and there was a very brief scuffle, but a gun was pulled, and one student was shot, and another is now facing murder charges. So that, of course, brought it home on a whole new level. There were already efforts underway with Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools to increase safety. They had gotten more counselors and psychologists. That's an ongoing push. They had gotten money for, they call them these panic alarm cards, where every employee or at least every faculty member will have something where they can signal, you know, different signals, anything from there's a fight in the hallway, so we need a couple of administrators to, you know, God forbid the worst case scenario, active shooter, you know, get everybody out of the way. So that was already going on, and in the wake of the Butler shooting, there was still some back and forth. The police chief, Kerr Putney, had been saying, I want to see metal detectors or wands. I want to see everybody screened to go into a school like you're screened to go into an airport. And the superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, had been saying, you know, we don't want to make our schools like prisons. This is not practical. This is not helpful. Following Butler, there were a series of, you know, additional guns, and Olympic High had a threat that was credible enough and involved a real gun that they ended up pretty much evacuating and closing down for that day. So kind of near the end of the year, we saw yet another round. And when the kids come back in January, the high school students at least, will be seeing unannounced wanding and or bag searches. And I use the word unannounced advisedly. Clayton Wilcox has been saying random searches, and that has really triggered a lot of people who feel like that means, you know, Glenn and I walk through the door and they search Glenn and not me. And I use that selection advisedly, because that is the belief, is that they will single out the African-American kids, as tends to happen. They have said this is not going to be singling out any kids on any basis. This is just going to be, you know, today for whatever reason we do Olympic High, and then the next day we do South Mech, and you're not going to know when it's your school's turn.
So that was obviously a huge story. The other big education story, or one of the other big education stories in Charlotte, in the state, involved bold moves on both sides in the long simmering battle between school systems and suburbs, particularly in Charlotte. So you had this HB 514, which I believe was backed by Representative Bill Brawley. It passed. It gave four of the suburban towns the right to build charter schools on their own. Let's start with Huntersville Mayor John Anarella, who sees this law as inevitable.
This is just an option that we may need, because if you look at the history of CMS and how they've treated the suburbs, there's been this disconnect.
And that was at odds with the opinion of Erica Ellis Stewart, who's a school board member. She says there's more to the charter school push than just choices.
We know that at the very root of this, it is about race. It is about economic division and class. And we have to call a spade a spade.
So that started the debate, and it kind of went downhill from there.
That discussion was certainly had vigorously, and we've talked about issues that come up year after year. Some of this was going on at this time last year. Bill Brawley had introduced House Bill 514, the charter school bill that would have allowed at that time just Matthews and Mint Hill to create their own charter schools. He had introduced that in 2017, and it did not get voted on. And he had also created a statewide panel to look at dividing school districts, large school districts like Wake and Mecklenburg, potentially into smaller ones. We did have a series of hearings around the state, a series of discussions and expert presentations. That kind of went nowhere. But, of course, House Bill 514 did come back. And Bill Brawley had always said, this isn't my baby, this is what my constituents want. So if they say they don't want it, it goes away. So we had a series of meetings between school board members and Matthewstown commissioners. I think the school board members really hoped to persuade them that, look, let's just work together. We don't need this. That didn't work. There was a split vote. And as it turned out, not only did Matthews and Mint Hill say, yeah, we'd still like to have this option, but as you quoted with John Anarella, Huntersville and Cornelius said, me too, we'd like to be in on this. So,
you know, there was a big dose of Charlotte versus Raleigh, or maybe it's Raleigh versus Charlotte politics in this. There were some folks who felt that the legislature did this as part of a long history of Raleigh doing things to Mecklenburg County and Charlotte that they don't like. HB2 comes to mind. But, you know, the politics got pretty thick right after that. And remember, the school board ended up with this secret resolution that ended up attempting to more or less punish these towns if they decided to go ahead with the idea of doing a charter school. And we had that last-minute resolution introduced at the school board meeting that one night where they said we're going to put these towns at a lower priority if they don't take the pledge to not build charter schools. And, of course, that only emboldened folks like John Anarella even more to push forward with this. Now we're hearing some talk that some other school districts might end up with this, might push for the same power. So
Ann, this sounds like much like the 9th Congressional District, we could be talking about this story a year from now.
Well, definitely the tension between the district and the suburbs has been going on for decades. And I don't think, as we're ending the year, things seem to be relatively smooth. We have the Municipal Education Advisory Committee meeting, and at least everybody's saying we're willing to sit down and try to plan together. Of course, you also have three, Matthews, Huntersville, and Cornelius have their own education task forces studying their options, which include everything from just working with CMS to actively pursuing the municipal charters to separating into smaller districts or trying to do that. So I think it's kind of like the couple on the soap operas that, you know, there's always some drama and every now and then, you know, they get back together, but you know something else is coming.
It's a great analogy.
Speaking of something else coming, the weather just kept coming. The storms kept coming. David, most obviously with Hurricane Florence in September. As I mentioned earlier, $17 billion worth of damage, at least 42 deaths in North Carolina. You went to Wilmington when Florence hit. What did you see? What did you find?
Well, I drove down 74 on Sunday morning as that storm stalled over southeastern North Carolina, and a trip that might take you about 3.5-4 hours took me 8 hours because of getting stranded in some places where the water was across the road. And I was driving through places like Columbus County that were just underwater, impassable. I met folks who couldn't get to their homes. It was pretty bad down through that area. When I got to Wilmington, the devastation was just jaw-dropping with the number of trees and down power lines throughout the city. There was no power anywhere. Folks were in shelters. There were some deaths there from the storm, from falling trees. One person died in a shelter. And so it was pretty bad down there in the week after the storm, and it was not clear when the power was going to come back, and it was very slow to come back. At the same time, you know, some of the worst damage happened like 6-7 days afterwards when all of the water that fell upstream filled the Cape Fear River and other rivers and started coming downstream. And Fayetteville got hit pretty hard, Wilmington and the towns north of there, New Bern, and they were flooded pretty heavily. And, you know, other side effects in eastern North Carolina were things like water treatment plants overrunning and coal ash ponds getting breached and the hog farms where the lagoons were overrun. And it created pollution problems that the legislature and the state officials are going to be talking about this year to try and figure out how to fix that.
Yeah, hog waste lagoons was one of those memorable phrases that came out of this horrible storm that I don't think many people wanted to even ponder, much less live near.
Well, and we've seen it before. You know, many people's memories of Hurricane Matthew just a couple of years ago are pretty strong. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion after these storms, and let's include Michael as well, which came up through the Gulf and from southwest of us. You know, we're getting these big storms more often. I think the governor several times in his speeches talked about we have these 500-year storms, and we've had two in 2 years. And I think the concern is that we need to do more to take a look at things that are near waterways and maybe protect ourselves a little better.
Since we are moving quickly through the news, let's talk about transportation. We had this year, Steve, I think you covered the opening of the Blue Line Extension, billion-dollar project from Uptown to UNCC. Tell us a little bit about why this project is important, but also how long it might be before we see another one of these ribbon cuttings.
So they extended the Blue Line from Uptown to UNC Charlotte, and that has been a huge goal of the university for many, many years, to kind of be better connected to the center city. It basically doubled the length of the Blue Line, and it has, it's interesting. It opened at a time when transit in Charlotte and across the country has really struggled to keep passengers. The Blue Line extension is carrying fewer people than they thought. Buses are carrying far fewer people than a year ago, 2 years ago. They've been on a steep decline. So you have the situation where transit is really struggling due to a lot of factors, cheap gas, ride share, et cetera. And so what will be, and at the same time, CATS has big, big plans to build a lot more trains. They want to build trains from Matthews to the airport, to Lake Norman, and they don't have the money for that right now. And at some point in 2019 or 2020, I think there will be some serious discussions about how to move this forward. And then there'll be a debate of, well, is this the best way to spend $6 or $7 billion?
And at the same time, David, I know you were following this closely. We had one project involving toll lanes that opened, and we had one that was delayed. Which is which?
Right. So the Monroe Expressway, which people may remember we called the Monroe Bypass for a while, it's about 20 miles that goes around Monroe through Union County. And it's a project that you could argue has been needed for years. If anybody has driven down US 74 through Monroe at any time of day, even on the weekend, it's a slow slog through there. And so the idea behind this road was to build something that would give those who need to go around Monroe a faster way to get there. And that road has opened now. It opened up in November. And haven't seen any usage statistics yet, but the folks who who go on 74 say that they're seeing some improvement, and they hope that you know, it will continue. That project is one that's being operated by the state, and the tolls are set, and they stay the same all day long. That's in contrast to I-77 north of Charlotte, where we have a 26-mile toll lane project that's being built by a private company, I-77 Mobility Partners. The promise was that would be done by the end of this year, and we've learned just in the middle of December here that project is not going to open, at least part of it won't open until the first quarter of the year, and then the rest of it probably not till the middle of the year. And the difference there is that this is operated by a private company. We didn't know for the longest time what the tolls will be. They've set some initial rates. I think it's like $13 round trip for a commuter if you go the whole way. Of course, it's a lot less if you're just driving from, and this road goes from Charlotte to Mooresville. So from Mooresville to Charlotte in the morning could cost you $13. And back at the end of the day will cost you $13. If you drive a shorter route, it'll be less. There's a lot of questions about, you know, the efficacy and the reasons for doing a private company on this. The argument was that the state didn't have the money and that this was the only way to do it. This is being privately financed, except for a small portion of it. But, you know, this is going to be a test for this kind of project. The state has several others on the drawing board for South Charlotte, for Independence Boulevard, for I-77 south of Charlotte. And the success of this one could determine whether those other ones are popular and whether they go forward.
I was going to say, I think it's going to be interesting, too. The test will be when the traffic statistics come out on the Monroe Expressway. I've driven it a few times because I've been making some trips to Bladen County.
And it makes, whatever for.
It makes the trip much faster, but there's just not a lot of cars on it. And a few years ago, the state had to kind of pull its revenue projections from that road way down. And there's no risk of default because it's the state's road and they've already paid for it. But I do think that it'll be interesting to see just how many people are taking it, because at the same time, as soon as they open that, they are making improvements on the old US 74 through Monroe. So it is a little faster to get through there from some of the stuff they've already done.
Maybe beach traffic at the least.
There may be a new road factor there too, though, because I remember when 485 opened and the southwest loop part of it was just, you know, you felt like you were driving down a runway, and now
used to be so pleasant.
Yes, now that is not an issue. That we have found our traffic. Over
well,
there.
Speaking of finding our traffic, now we can move on to the most important story probably in the universe, which is the invasion of scooters. So, 2018 scooters everywhere uptown, and as I understand it, we're going to have even more in 2019. Is that correct? Are we having expansion of scooters? Does anybody know?
That's right. We have another company that's coming, and at the end of 2018 here, now the city has declared that its trial of the scooters is over, and now they are talking with the companies about how the program will expand and evolve and whether any rules are required. We'll have three companies in here doing this, and there's really two camps on this. There are some folks who think that this is a scourge that has come to the sidewalks of downtown, and by the way, you're not supposed to drive them on the sidewalks downtown. You can drive them on the sidewalks in other parts of town, but you know, are they a scourge that creates safety problems? We've had a few accidents so far. Or are they a really important element in the transportation network? And you do see, the other day I was near the transportation center walking up back to the blue line from the government center, and a bus let off at the transportation center, and I saw this swarm of people walk across the street to a bunch of scooters there, and they all got on and went off in their directions. And what Katz is telling us is that they are become an important part of the last mile, is what they call it, which is helping people get to public transportation like buses and trains and that sort of thing. So the numbers tell us that, remember, this is also the year of the rental bicycle, the bicycle sharing program, and it turns out that the scooters have been way more popular, like four or five times more popular than the bicycles have been. In fact, one of the companies has pulled its bicycles out and just concentrating on scooters right now.
How very American that is. I'm going to interrupt you, David. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the RNC, we're going to talk about the late Billy Graham, and we're going to talk about a new billionaire in town. This is the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
WFAE is looking for the next great podcast from the Charlotte area. No idea is too big, no story is too small. Submit your podcast idea by January 27th at wfae.org/Queen City Pod Quest.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and you're listening to the Local News Roundup's Year in Review with Steve Harrison of WFAE, Glenn Birkins from Q City Metro, and Os Helms of the Charlotte Observer, and WFAE's David Borax. So we started this year with a ho-hum announcement that Charlotte wanted to host the 2020 Republican National Convention. But as it got closer and the odds got better, Democrats found themselves deeply divided about whether to vote in favor of bringing the Republican convention to town, including Councilman Braxton Winston.
The crux of this decision rests on the effect of one man, Donald Trump. You see, I don't really see him as a Republican. I see him as a human avatar of white supremacy.
So Winston's fellow Democrat on council, Larkin Eggleston, ended up casting the deciding vote to bring the convention to Charlotte.
Hosting the RNC in Charlotte in no way implies our endorsement of this president or the policies of his administration. It only proves Charlotte is a diverse, inclusive city capable of taking on big challenges. I will not combat the disappointing characteristics of this president by emulating them.
Thank you, Glenn.
I didn't mean to interrupt the applause. Glenn, 2019 is an election year for the mayor and the council, as you know. How do you think this RNC vote affects the campaigns and the races?
It's going to be difficult to tell. I know that there is some disappointment out there among Democrats, especially in the African American community. I still see, and it's anecdotal, but I still see things on Facebook where people are referring to the mayor's decision to open negotiations to bring them here, RNC here. I think it will probably cost her some votes. Will it cost her enough votes to actually deny her a second term? It's anyone's guess. There are a lot of Democrats who don't want the RNC in town.
Is it good for Mayor Lyles that Republicans are so happy with her right now?
Well, I don't think it hurts. I think it's always good when people like you. You know, at the end of the day, will that translate into votes for her? I don't know. I think a lot will depend on who's running against her.
One of the things I'm wondering about, Steve, you cover city government closely as well, is, of course, former Mayor Patrick Cannon, as of January, would be eligible to reapply for his voting rights and his right to run for office. Any chance he appears on the ballot next year, you think?
I mean, that seems to be what people think. And I think, Eric, I mean, you spoke with him briefly about that idea, and he did not dismiss it. He lives in a heavily Republican, or increasingly more Democratic, district in South Charlotte, so he could run there, which would be difficult, or run at large. And there would be kind of a logjam of incumbents and possibly the former mayor. I was going to just say one more thing, go back to the RNC. I think it's interesting that when the city decided to bid on the convention, it was, to me, such a throwback to kind of old Charlotte of, like, we want to get everything possible. We want to be on the map. And you never heard anything from the council members about, is this a good idea? And I'd kind of ask them, and they'd say, well, of course we want this. And so Charlotte had this own kind of thought about the RNC. And meanwhile, pretty much every other city in the country came to a different conclusion. And as it got closer, Charlotte kind of looked around and realized they were all alone in bidding for this.
Just by the way, I want to interrupt real quick, David. I want you to know that Charlotte is undefeated in contests where there's no opponent. Go ahead.
I was going to say, did Charlotte step up or did everyone else step back?
Yeah, that was one of those cases. Yeah.
I didn't know if you had something else you wanted to mention about the convention. Here's a quick question for everyone, which is, when the Republicans get here in August of 2020, who is the nominee?
Well, the fight here, I don't think would have happened if Donald Trump were not the president right now. And, you know, I think you described what it would have been like in the past, Steve. You're absolutely right. I mean, if Jeb Bush, let's just throw out a name, was president, I think people would have gone along with that. But Trump has been so polarizing, and this bid by the city came at a time when it was, you know, the polarization was just getting wider and wider. And I think that's what inspired this really kind of ugly behind-the-scenes debate among some of the Democrats on the council about whether this was a good thing or not. Will Trump be the nominee? That's the question of the hour. There's two questions there. One is, will he even want to run again after the first 4 years of his term? And he'll be making that decision in the next year or so. And obviously,
but he's certainly been campaigning actively from the moment he was elected. Yeah,
holding MAGA rallies all over the country. He's raising money. It looks like he will run again, but he's going to be even more beaten down. I mean, lots of stories about, you know, how it's shrunk down now to him by himself in the White House. You see some of his close advisors starting to step away at this point. And I think, you know, there's always the question about whether he will want to run again. I think most likely he will be the nominee unless something happens.
I'm giving it a 75% chance.
You are? Anybody anybody have Haley Pence or Pence Haley?
I think he runs. And I think one thing that's going to be interesting about when the RNC comes, I think Uptown will be completely open for business. That's big hotels, big restaurants. I think there's going to be this movement among some small businesses. I think there may be kind of some of this, like, opt out. I think some people may just pack up and shut down, either from the idea of, like, you know what, we're worried about violence or protests, or some businesses say, eh, you know what, we're just, it's not our thing. And I think there's going to be so much media, you know, newspaper and TV pieces done about Charlotte and what the citizens think, there's going to be so much material for the national press.
This administration is such a fast-moving story. We just saw the defense secretary resign. There are signs that the nation's economy might be slowing. There's just so much going on that trying to guess what's going to happen in 2 years is really difficult.
And you pointed out to me another story that we, another trend that we followed very closely last year, which was the homicide rate in Charlotte. We talked about that over and over and over. And then this year, it's kind of subsided as a sort of front page topic. What's going on there?
Well, I think this may be the ultimate no news is good news situation, although it's certainly not that there have been no homicides, unfortunately. But last year, there was such angst because the rate was just spiking. We had 87 homicides in 2017, higher than, I think it was a 12-year high. Very few years had even rivaled that. And there was never a clear cause. It wasn't like there was a big gang war or, you know, any one obvious cause. Likewise, this year, you have individuals who decide to do the wrong thing, and the year is not completely over. But as of December 20th, which is the most recent numbers I have, we've had 54 homicides. And again, that's compared with 87 for the full year of 2017. So, and again, you know, I asked our police reporter, Jane Wester, you know, what's going on here? And the short answer is, we don't know.
And it is a trend that's being echoed nationwide as well. And, you know, we know that a lot has been done over the past couple of years in Charlotte to try and address this issue. And the police are trying to do more with the community. And, it's something that is a little befuddling, but we're happy to see it. And it may also just be cyclical.
Exactly. There are times when trends justify explanation. Back during the 80s and 90s, we had the crack epidemic, which actually led to a lot of homicides, gang violence, things like that. I'm not sure we'll ever know why crime spikes 1 year and falls the next.
David, one of Charlotte's most famous sons, perhaps its most famous son, Reverend Billy Graham, died in February at age 99. Many tributes followed. Here are Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush on the late Billy Graham.
Those of us who are Christians believe in a God of second chances, and the politicians need those more than anybody else, so you got to cut him a little slack for trying to give a willing ear and an open heart.
If there's such a thing as a humble shepherd of the Lord, Billy Graham is that person.
David, what stood out to you as you were covering the life and the death of Billy Graham?
Well, you know, it strikes me that, again, we've been talking about the situation in Washington and our president and the attitude around all of that. You know, this funeral happened at, again, the time when the polarization is getting wider, and it reminded us that Billy Graham was really the closest thing we've had in our lifetimes to a national spiritual leader. He could always be counted on at tough times and good times to have words that kind of brought us together when we needed it. And, you know, that's not the situation in Washington right now, and we kind of need that. And I think a lot of people felt, as all of those kind words were being said about Billy Graham, that, boy, we really miss having something like that. You know, it doesn't take away from the fact that there was some controversy during his lifetime. I mean, he kind of stuck with presidents at a time when they were out of favor, and you know, that may have not made him as many friends as he might have had otherwise. But that funeral was a couple thousand people came from all over the country. His kids all spoke and talked about. And what struck me about that was they didn't talk about their dad as a national leader. They talked about their dad as a father and a husband and somebody that made a difference in their lives. And I think it was a good reminder for folks that, you know, when we lose a loved one, that it's, you know, that's the first thing we care about. And, I mean, it was a wonderful ceremony. The president was there along with the ex-presidents, and you wouldn't even have been able to tell that Donald Trump was at that ceremony because I think the immenseness of Billy Graham's life and accomplishments kind of overshadowed everything there.
Now, in 1996, Billy Graham held a crusade at the brand-new Carolina Panthers Stadium in Uptown Charlotte, which is now, of course, known as Bank of America Stadium. This year, the future of that stadium and how the franchise will be run became a near constant topic when David Tepper bought the Carolina Panthers. Remind us how and why that happened.
You know, Tepper, so this happened in the middle of controversy. Remember Jerry Richardson, Sports Illustrated article, interviewing some folks close to him, raised some allegations of sexual and racial misconduct by Richardson and put a cloud over the team. And Richardson had always said that, you know, he would sell the team when he died and that that was the most likely scenario. This kind of moved that timeline up. And in the middle of that controversy, as those allegations were being aired, Richardson announced that he was selling the team immediately. And that set up a really interesting months of bidding among all kinds of rich folks. People were talking about, you know, which corporate leader might do it. I think Oprah was mentioned. Steph Curry, the basketball player, was in the mix. And there was a lot of questioning about who it would be. And in the end, Tepper was the man left standing. He paid, I think, $2.2 billion, which was a record for an NFL franchise. And he came to town in July and announced himself. And, you know, first thing he said, the first words out of his mouth in response to a question about those harassment claims was that it's going to be a whole new day here, and immediately said he was setting his sights on a Super Bowl rings for the team. And, of course, the end of the season here, it's not going so well. But
I was going to say, can we laugh now?
Yeah, we can. Anytime a new leader comes to an organization like that, the question is what changes are going to happen. And certainly we've seen changes in the front office. He's talked a lot about activating Bank of America Stadium. He wants to bring high school games in there, maybe MLS soccer. And then there's the question about both the Panthers, where they are for headquarters and the practice facilities. And we've heard in the last couple of weeks that they may be looking at a site in South Carolina. We'll be looking for some news about that in 2019. The team's moving its practice site and headquarters to Fort Mill might be a little bit of a bruise to Charlotte, but the games will still be here, and I think that's the most important thing.
Steve, I know you have covered the political machinations of the Panthers and the Hornets and just sports in general. When you look at an anticipated request for public money to renovate that stadium in Charlotte, what's your sense of where not only the mayor but council and other political leaders are?
I think they will be all in. Or maybe not completely all in. I'm not saying they would support a new stadium, but I don't think there's going to be any real resistance to putting more money into the stadium. I think the city has already set aside, I can't remember the number, but they already have money set aside in their hospitality taxes. They've kind of set aside money for the Panthers, not enough for a new stadium, but for another round of renovations. I think there's some things that they can do to the stadium to squeeze some more money out of it. You know, a big new trend in a lot of NFL new stadiums is putting suites at the field level. You see that in Dallas and Minnesota, Atlanta, I think. So there's some things they can do to the stadium to make more money. I think that'll be coming. And, you know, going back to the practice facility, if it moves, you know, I would assume a lot of the players and the executives would still live in North Carolina.
And so moving the practice facility does open up the land that the Panthers own near the stadium for possible redevelopment, and that could be something that brings additional revenue to the team. It could be something that solves the Panthers' parking problem, which is that they don't own any of the parking around the stadium. Tepper has said that's one of the things he'll be looking at.
Steve, I think you went up to Minnesota and saw the Vikings' new training center, and there's this trend in the NFL where you build this headquarters and then a lot of the teams control the real estate around it so that they can bring in more revenue. Is that something you think works in suburban Charlotte or across the state line in South Carolina, wherever it goes?
I think so. So what the Vikings did, they went out into the suburbs and built this big complex with their practice facility, headquarters, et cetera. They built a stadium that they play in sometimes, and also that the stadium hosts high school games and other events. Then you take that, you build stores and offices and retail around it. The Vikings moved their training camp there. So I think you could see a situation where if the Panthers do build this new facility, they leave Spartanburg and come to South Carolina, to closer to Charlotte.
So we can add that to the list of stories that we'll be talking about a year from now. We've got the training center, we've got the suburban school divide, and of course, for Steve, who will be driving on the Monroe Expressway to go to Bladen County, we will have the 9th Congressional District. Before we go, we've got just a few seconds left. Does anybody have a prediction on the biggest story of 2019? Any expectations? Crickets. Okay.
I think
there
the Supreme Court will find political gerrymandering illegal, unconstitutional.
Oh, that's a big one. All right. Anybody else before we wrap up?
I have made bullet home.
Okay. Very good. I want to thank Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Glenn Birkins from Cue City Metro, and WFAE's David Borax and Steve Harrison. You've been listening to the Local News Roundup. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.